radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hello, this is Dr. Burton Clark. Welcome to Leadership on the Line. The title of the program today is EMS, Japanese and United States. What can we learn? My guests today are Dr. Sugimoto from the Kokushikan University, who is a professor there and surgeon, Assistant Fire Chief for EMS Rafael Sajeda with the Washington, D.C. Fire Department, and Leo Bosner, a former Mansfield Fellow who arranged all these things. So welcome to everyone. Leo, can you just give us a little overview of the whole Mansfield Fellowship Program and how you got involved and how it brought us here today?
Sure, Bert. The Mansfield Fellowship Program is an effort to try to help get better understanding between the Japanese and U.S. governments, the people who actually do the work in the Defense Department, the Treasury Department, and so on, and FEMA, where I worked before retiring. So a few years back, I was successful in getting into it, where we all had, as federal employees, 1 year of Japanese language training here in the Washington area. Then we all went over to Tokyo, Japan, and spent 1 year over there working in the counterparts to our respective agencies. Basically, exchanging information with them. How do we do this in the U.S.? How do you do it in Japan? And trying to learn from each other. So as a FEMA guy, I was looking at such things as emergency medical services, hospital disaster plans, evacuation plans in case of earthquakes, and things like that.
Super. And may I impose upon you to give the introduction to the show in Japanese, so we may have some Japanese folks listening today.
Minasan arashimase. Kuchira ga Leadership on the Line. Toimasu no radio show desu. Host wa Dr. Burton Clark. Burt Clark sensei desu. Burt Clark wa FEMA no shokuin desu. Soshite nagai aida fire chief, shobo chief deshita. Soshite EMS ni tsuite mo shimashita. Soshite Kokushikan Daigaku no Sugimoto sensei mo imasu. Tokyo kara kimashita. Soshite Washington shobo no Saada, Deputy Chief Saada-san mo imasu. Saada-san wa EMS Director no Washington Shobo no Naka desu. Arigatou gozaimasu.
Thank you very much, Leo. I appreciate that. So now we'll turn to Dr. Sugimoto. You've had a chance to be with the DC Fire and EMS all day today, from this morning until now, lots of different locations. If you recall all the places that we went to today, can you just identify something important or something you learned at each one of the locations that we went to today?
16 engine.
That's where we are now, yes sir.
This is very nice, impressive place, because our colleagues can join your ambulance crew to see the city. It's a very nice idea for us.
So they're actually going to, they were assigned to ride out with various EMS crews today, yes. The other thing that you did while you were here is you actually looked at one of our paramedic units.
That's right.
And they took you around that. How would you compare our paramedic units to the paramedic units like in Tokyo or in Japan?
Your system, the car and cars, very sophisticated system. We cannot compare because in Japanese cars and fire tank and ambulance very small. So we can do little things in the car.
Okay,
just problem.
Smaller. And I also understand that the Japanese paramedics can't use quite as many of the drugs that the American paramedics can use.
Oh, only Japanese paramedics can use epinephrine for the CPA patient. Okay. That's the only way for them.
This is not a paramedic question, but do all of the EMS units carry automatic defibrillators on them?
Yes, it's the same in Japan.
Okay,
yes.
All right, very good. The other place that we went today before we came down to Engine 16 was Howard University Hospital.
Yes.
And you were able to meet the director and the person in charge of EMS and take a tour. What do you think got your attention at the hospital?
That is a level one trauma center.
Yes.
Level one trauma center is very, very famous for Japanese surgeon, tribal surgeon. So but I think the scale and size, not so big. I think that hospital and the emergency center, trauma center.
Okay. Yes. And before that, we visited the DC Communication Center.
Yes.
And you were able to talk to one of the EMS liaison officers.
Yes.
About what they do, talking to the units. Any observations about that?
Yes, we had very impressive thing. Your personnel in the ambulance can talk to the hospital person directly. Is it right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In Japan, it cannot. They should call back to the station, and the station side the hospital, and the station call the personnel in the hospital, and the station select the hospital, and the station call back again ambulance. Two times four compared to U.S. Very convenient for U.S. system, I see.
Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Let me turn now to Chief Saeda. In terms of, you gave us a briefing this morning, Chief, in terms of what DC EMS system has gone through. And just give us a little highlight in terms of the major changes that you've undergone over the past few years, if you don't mind.
Well, certainly I'd be happy to, Dr. Clark. We're on a pretty extraordinary journey with the leadership of Mayor Fenty and our chief, Fire and EMS Chief Dennis L. Rubin. We've embarked on a journey to significantly enhance the position of EMS as the core element of our mission and its structural importance within the agency. So it's a broad-based mission to improve quality of care and to ensure that we're matching the need for both high-quality care and the extraordinary demand in such a high-volume system. And we have perhaps the highest per capita usage of 911 services for emergency medical care of any jurisdiction in the United States. So some of the highlights of our accomplishments is that we've doubled the number of EMS supervisors on duty at all times, so that we now have 10 EMS supervisors, 24/7, 365. Eight of them are based in the field, and there's one assigned to each battalion. And we've created an integrated battalion management team concept, whereby the paramedic captain or the EMS supervisor works directly in the same office, their desks are co-located with the battalion fire chief under the same schedule. And it's a joint team that's held collectively responsible for managing the operational affairs of that battalion. That's really improved the lines of communication and reporting, and it gives each battalion fire chief the subject matter expertise they need to make sure that EMS is being managed effectively within that geographic battalion. We also have a citywide EMS supervisor assigned to the Special Operations Division, who's responsible for responses on target hazards and special operations, and has additional specialized technical training. On a day like today, when we're dealing with multiple building collapses and so on, it's very important to have that that specialized supervisor. And then we have two paramedic supervisors at our Office of Unified Communications, which is our PSAP, and their job is centralized system management. And what they're doing is they're looking at all of the EMS resources in the city in real time, as well as conditions in the hospital. And they have taken over the distribution of patient destination decisions, such that our transport units no longer decide which hospital they're going to take a particular patient to. What they do is they complete their assessment, they contact the ELO, and they give the ELO a six-point report, which states the critical information that's necessary to choosing the appropriate transport destination, the age and gender of the patient, of course, but the perceived treatment transport priority, the perceived chief complaint, and most specifically, is this a STEMI, is this a trauma, is this a stroke, is this a pediatric patient, is there a burn, elements that would go to a specialty center. And then vital signs if they're outside of normal limits, and then any other medical information that's relevant to the destination decision. What the ELO then does is collate this information, look at all of the hospitals in real time, and determine what's the level of patients that are at each one. And specifically, it's very common, particularly during peak hours, where we have high concentrations of people downtown, where everybody's going to particular hospitals, both for walk-ins and then from ambulance transports. And what we try to do is balance the distribution of the patients across all of the hospitals in the system and try to keep the conditions that cause hospital closure and diversion from occurring in the first place, but to do so in a way that's medically appropriate. So that a patient that needs to go to the closest specialty center goes to that specialty center, but the patient that has a less severe injury or illness who is stable can perhaps go to a less busy emergency department that's slightly more peripheral to the central city core. And we have found this has been very effective. Working in partnership with the hospitals, we have completely eliminated hospital diversion in the District of Columbia. And that's a collective accomplishment in partnership with the hospitals that we're very proud of.
Yeah, that was an amazing revolution for me when I heard that's what you were doing, because I can remember my time when the ambulance, we'd have hospital closings all the time, but we'd have to go across the river to deliver a patient. And I was even impressed when we visited Howard today that at first the hospitals couldn't believe that there could be a no hospital closure, but now they're very excited about it because they get enough patients, they can do what they need to do, but they don't have patients backed up. So it really does seem to have satisfied both the street EMS system and the hospital system to solve a problem that both of them had. And it gives that better service to that patient.
Well, Bert, what we say is that EMS is a system. It's not an agency, it's a system. And any effort at systemic improvement has to involve the hospitals in partnership. Mm-hmm. We meet monthly with the hospital leaders, the nursing coordinators, the emergency department directors, the lead emergency physicians, the medical director and myself have a monthly standing meeting whereby we discuss every element of system management. We review each hospital's performance statistics. We review our system performance statistics. It's very transparent. Everybody gets to see everybody else's numbers, and we collectively solve issues. And it's that level of trust and partnership that's essential to moving EMS forward, not just in our city, but in any city in the United States.
One of the other things I was very impressed with today in your presentation was about how you measure the effectiveness of your EMS intervention, not just by how quickly you get there, but also those matrix in terms of patient outcomes for those various types of things. And I was wondering, Dr. Sugimoto, if in Japan they have similar kinds of measures of success of the EMS system in terms of how quickly they do various things on the patient, if it goes to the right hospital, like we were presented this morning.
Yes, in Japan. Now, it's a big problem. Shortage of the doctors and nurses. Mm. Not for all hospitals, but some hospitals refuse to receive the patient because they have a lot of patients. We can do nothing for new patients, so we cannot receive new patients, they say. Mm. So sometimes ambulances stay on the scene 30 minutes or 40 minutes or 60 minutes because they cannot choose a correct hospital because all near hospital cannot receive new patients. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem.
Big problem.
But why that? The reason why these hospitals cannot receive the new patients, some doctors run away from the hospital. They say, we can do nothing for anymore because we are very, very busy. So we will move to other hospitals more easy ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a big problem just now.
I see. Okay. The other thing, one of the things I was fascinated watching the Discovery Channel and stuff, in the medical profession today, there's this concept called chasing zero, if you're familiar with it. It's about reducing medical errors actually in the hospital setting to try to solve that problem. And making checklists up and checking the checker and make it when a patient comes in for surgery, the patient writes what arm they're supposed to be operated on, and they have to say, all right, what are you here for today? And they collect all that kind of stuff to really reduce those human error kinds of things. And you talked about how you were trying to do that out in the field too, and the basic premise of the difference between human error that's a training problem as a human error that's a punishment problem. Can you talk about that for a minute, please, Chief?
Certainly. We're trying to build what we call a culture of quality. And a key element to building a culture of quality is that recognizing that EMS is the practice of medicine and the way medical professionals are going to make errors. That is just a fact. And when you have a large volume of patient contacts or interactions, that increases the likelihood of the number of errors that are going to occur. The only way an organization can improve is if it's willing to acknowledge and learn from its mistakes. So it's very important for us in terms of building a culture of quality that we build a culture in which providers can trust that they can self-report their own mistakes in real time as they're occurring and trust that the errors will be remediated through education and training as opposed to punishment and discipline. And that's a bit of a paradigm shift for the fire service because we are a paramilitary organization and traditionally any error was dealt with through discipline, through an atmosphere of fear, but that's completely contrary to the delivery of high quality medicine. So it's very important. So what we've done is we've separated the medical quality review process from the operations side and it's handled entirely in the office of the medical director and it's done under peer review protection. Such that legitimate medical errors where a patient, where a provider was trying to do the right thing and maybe made a mistake, can be addressed the vast majority of cases with remedial strategies that involve training and education. That does not mean that there are occasionally cases of gross negligence or a provider who simply didn't care and chose to do the wrong thing even though they knew what the right thing to do was. So clearly those areas are going to go over into discipline. So building a culture of quality is critical. And the checklist concept is critical as well. We were very highly influenced. Atul Gawande, Dr. Gawande, wrote in The New Yorker about the checklist concept. And I think that article highlighted how the field of medicine is realizing that the use of checklists, which is common in some industries, and the airline industry would be a perfect example, really improves and reduces the likelihood of medical errors. So where we've adopted the checklist concept, to give it a concrete example, is in the use of non-transports. We do not have provider-initiated non-transports, but we do have patient-initiated refusals. And what we found is we weren't happy with the quality that we were seeing on the patient-initiated refusals. And we had a very well-written protocol, but the best written protocol in the world is useless if it's not being utilized properly. So what we've established is a checklist so that when a provider is faced with a situation where the patient, for whatever reason, is declining treatment and transport, provider calls in to our EMS liaison officer, the EMS supervisor, and the EMS liaison officer walks them through a checklist that enumerates each of the steps that's required to be in compliance with our non-transport protocol. And it starts with the basics, determining is this patient legally, medically, and situationally competent to make this decision? Has this patient been advised of the risks of refusing treatment and transport, up to and including death? And have you exhausted all possible mechanisms or means for trying to persuade this patient to accept treatment and transportation? What were your findings on physical exam? So on. So we go through each of these, and the idea is to try to make sure that we're doing our absolute best to be that patient's advocate, even if that patient may not necessarily be the best advocate for themselves. It's our responsibility as well. And we found that that's dramatically improved performance in this area. And this is an example of how the checklist concept can really improve medical quality.
Maybe this is probably an unfair question, but how have the actual EMTs and paramedics in the field responded to that?
Well, I think that there is a bit of there's always going to be pushback when you add new steps in. And so part of the learning piece for us is making sure that they understand we're asking these questions not because we don't trust you, but because we want to provide you with additional support. This is for your own protection. This is for your own benefit. We're here to help you. And it'd probably be fairer to ask that question to the line personnel than to ask the guy at the top of the food chain. But I believe that we've made significant progress. What we're trying to reinforce with our EMS providers is if you're faced with a challenging situation, you're not sure what the right thing to do is to call for help. Call for help. And that's why we've doubled the number of supervisors. And that's why we have a supervisor immediately available to you just by the click of a radio button. There's a paramedic supervisor that's there to provide you with that assistance. And we will dispatch a supervisor to that scene. If you're patients who are refusing treatment and transport are some of the most challenging patients that we have to deal with. So we want to get that higher level, more experienced provider there to help you with that interaction. And in no way do we want our people out there on their own without any support. So I think that message is getting across.
Yeah. When I get on an airplane, I know for sure that I'm hoping and wishing that my pilot and co-pilot go through the checklist. Even if I don't see them do it, I know that process is being done, and that does give me some kind of comforts. Another area I'd like you gentlemen to talk about for a minute is the whole issue of repeat patients that almost abuse the emergency EMS system. And that's been a real problem in D.C. Is that a problem in Japan where people, for whatever reason, don't really need to go to the hospital, but they're calling EMS all the time? Are you faced with that same problem?
Yes, in Japan we have the same problem, but not so too many. Some patients visit hospital again, but not so many. So now we have no new idea to solve that. Every time we receive the patient and say to the patient, you have no problem with medical care. Just maybe you have some psychological problem or social problem. So you should go to other office about social worker and so on. So in Japan, we maybe all hospitals receive such patients.
Well, even though you may not have as many as D.C., you did mention that some of your hospitals have to close down or take no more patients. Yes. This is an unfair question because you haven't been able to look it up, but do you think there may be patients in the waiting room or in ER that don't really need to be there, and that would be one of the reasons why they had to close down for that time period?
As you know, the Japanese emergency care system is different from the U.S. In Japan, we have primary, secondary, tertiary care system. A severe patient directly go to the tertiary care, like level 1 trauma center. Mm-hmm. We can go by ambulance. Not severe patients can go to the primary care, like the clinic.
The clinic?
Or secondary hospital. The middle case of the hospital, they go. So, on the side, many patients will be triaged by the severity. Big hospital or university hospital will have not so much many waiting patients. But in your cases,
yes.
Emergency center have too many patients waiting. They're waiting 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, but in Japan it's not quite there.
And along the same lines, Chief, I know the D.C. Fire Department started the street calls program, which really helped reduce your frequent flyers, as we refer to them, but people that really do need assistance. Would you just talk about that street calls program?
Sure, I'd be honored to. Now, I will take exception to two terms that you used.
I said that, I realized I shouldn't have said it.
but these are terms that are used throughout our industry.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to be afraid to say them, but I'll explain why we don't like them. So we don't like the term 911 abuse, and we don't like the term frequent flyer.
Right.
And ultimately, I think it's disrespectful to our patients as human beings. But more importantly, it's very important to understand that if anything, the term of art would be misuse of 911 or inappropriate use as opposed to abuse. It's very important to understand that our high-volume 911 system users have profound needs and complex needs. What is obvious, though, is that in many cases, using fire trucks and ambulances and the 911 system and hospital emergency departments to address those needs is an extraordinarily inefficient way to try to get at their underlying problem. But make no mistake about it, this is a highly vulnerable, at-risk population. They're very brittle. What we find is we track our high-volume system users. Many of them wind up dying. Just as in the course of our longitudinal tracking, we find that every year several of them die because of the severity of their underlying issues. And, of course, the underlying issues, we know what some of the dynamics are. The alcoholism or other substance abuse, the disease of addiction, the mental illness, and homelessness, and very often the constellation of all three combined in one patient. So these are patients with profound needs, and what we're trying to do is, as we identify high-volume system users, we've created a multidisciplinary team of paramedics with specialized training and specialized talents who try to intervene and track these high-volume system users down and establish files so we can get them linked up with the city services or other services that are actually going to solve their underlying issues. And whether those issues are mental health treatment, detox, rehabilitation, something as simple as just getting them into housing, that very often will solve the issue that's causing them to dial 911 in the first place. Just make no mistake about it, these patients aren't dialing 911 every day because it's a fun thing to do or because that's what they like to do. They have no other options, or to them this seems to be a rational option. And in many cases, it's other people are dialing 911 for them. So in some of our chronic public inebriates, they're not even the ones initiating the call. But they clearly place a heavy burden of resource drain on the system. So we have been very successful with our street calls team. These are two vans with two paramedics in each unit. They go out, they track our high volume system users, they work with them, they work with their families to try to solve their underlying issues and connect them with mental health or the other services they need. And we have achieved a 75% reduction in the 911 usage from this target population. And this is a program that a lot of fire and EMS departments across the United States are working to implement. Most of us were inspired by San Francisco's home team, which was one of the first and best of this type of program, the work that Captain Niels Tangerlini did at San Francisco Fire and EMS. We're seeing similar programs around the United States. This is just a concept that makes a lot of sense for every fire and EMS agency.
And it really does take the whole notion of customer service to another level. Instead of waiting for the customer to come find us, we know their needs, and if we're a service agency, we can go out and try to provide those needs before they need to be a customer, because we're taking care of other things in their lives that need to be addressed.
Absolutely. And the fire service has long understood that prevention is the absolute best firefighting strategy. And certainly in EMS, we have a responsibility for illness and injury prevention, and we need to realize that we are part of the public health system. EMS is where public health intersects with public safety. And clearly, we have a responsibility to be involved in not just taking patients to the hospital, but also in educating our patients, identifying systemic trends in health in our respective jurisdictions, and helping implement strategies to address those needs.
Right. And Leo, let me come back to you, because it wasn't too long ago you had to use the District of Columbia EMS system from on the street all the way up to Level 1 Trauma Center. Would you just like to share your experience with the audience?
Yeah, Burton. Well, it's not fun to get hit by a car. I was pretty impressed by how well our system operates in D.C., happily impressed and surprised. About 4 years ago, I was bicycling into my office in the morning when a gentleman talking on his cell phone while driving turned in front of me. I was wearing a bike helmet, but I still went up and over, came down pretty hard on the pavement, had a cracked collarbone, some bruised ribs, and got up, and the gentleman let me use his cell phone to call 911. And by the time I was pushing the button for the ending the call, I could hear the siren of the apparatus coming up the street to pick me up. Very professional at that end. Then we went to Howard University Hospital, and I can just say nothing but good about that place. They were very professional. They're very welcoming. They made me comfortable. I wasn't life-threatening injuries, but I was in quite a bit of pain. It really hurts to have that happen to you, especially when you're an old 60-year-old guy like me. They were very friendly, very professional. They took care of me. The nurses joked with me. And then when I went back for my follow-up visit a couple of weeks later, the doctor, I can't think of his name now, was extremely knowledgeable, professional, went through everything about my injuries, explained what I had, explained what I might expect, answered every question I had. So like I say, it's not nice for something like that to happen. I'm very happy at that point that I lived in D.C. with a good emergency response system, and I'm very happy that Howard University Hospital is nearby, because they just did a great job.
Well, super. We're getting close to the end of the show, gentlemen, so I'm just going to go around the table and ask if you have any closing comments or observations you'd like to make about our question, EMS, Japan and the U.S., what can we learn? So if I can go to you, Chief, how would you answer that question?
Well, I would simply say it's a wonderful opportunity to meet with such professionals from Japan. The visit of Dr. Sugimoto and the assistant professor and the Japanese paramedics is the type of exchange that should be happening across the world. We clearly have a responsibility to exchange information and share best practices, because we all have so much to learn from each other. And they were an extremely professional group, and it was an honor to meet and to work with them. And they're certainly welcome to come back to the District of Columbia anytime. It was a pleasure and an honor meeting you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chief. And Dr. Sugimoto, how would you answer that test question? EMS, Japan and U.S., what can we learn from each other?
Yes, we are very lucky because we can meet Dr. Clark and Chief and also Leo. If possible, we would like to continue our relationship in academic, you know, in friends. Maybe next year or the other side, we will come up again and to meet you and to continue to learn from your techniques and systems.
And may I invite you to speak in your native language to the Japanese audience in terms of what you learned and how we can learn from each other?
Yes, okay. Morichimura, shock trauma, which is a famous daisho center. There, people who have been あなたはラッキーだった。ボルチモアで怪我したショックトラウマがあるから、ここで命を助けたんだ。先ほどのレオの話があったように、ハワードユニバーシティ病院、極めて、優れたレベル1トラウマセンターです。こちらで怪我をされても十分に安心だと思います。OK。
Thank you very much. And Leo, one more observation about the whole Mansfield program and how important that is, and what your future wishes are in terms of the relationship between Japan and the United States.
Well, I think the Mansfield program was just one good example of the good way that Japanese and Americans can learn from each other. Our two countries are friends. It's one of the countries I can go to where if you say you're an American, they really like you and they welcome you there, which is nice. When you're talking about the EMS systems, I look at this, it's almost the same as looking at the two countries. I think that Japan has a very high stress on high quality. Things from Japan are very good quality. I think in the U.S. culture, we put a lot of stress on opportunity to improve and change things if we see problems. And both of those, I think we can learn a lot from the Japanese about how to raise the quality of just a lot of the things we do in everyday life in our corporations and our government and our emergency services. And I think the Japanese, under the leadership of people like Dr. Sugimoto, can try to push their system a little bit and bring about the needed changes and look at these opportunities for improvement, and both of us can build stronger systems.
And again, if I may impose on you, Leo, if you'd like to use your Japanese skills to sign off today, I'd appreciate that.
Minasan, boku no hata nihongo gomenasai. Watashi ga nihonjin de wa arimasen. Watashi ga kantana amerikajin dake desu. Ga tonikaku nihonjin wa tomodachi ga takusan arimasu. Toku ni shobo ya jiitai ya byouin ya ishin nado no hito. Desu kara boku no nihonjin no tomodachi ni honto wa anata no shigoto nitsuite omeritou gozaimasu. Soshite ganbatte kudasai ne.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. This is Dr. Burton Clark. You've been listening to Leadership on the Line. We'll see you later. Bye.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.